Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the South Bay Show, Preparing for Disaster in America, on Tuesday, July 2nd, 2013. I'm your host, Joe Terry, and the South Bay Show is brought to you by Tapas and Vino. Located in the heart of Riviera Village, Tapas and Vino offers an idyllic location to meet and eat and has quickly become a favorite destination of local foodies. This charming bistro offers an eclectic menu of small plates, salads, soups, and entrees for lunch and dinner daily. In addition, brunch is served every Saturday and Sunday with endless, yes, that's right, endless, mimosas and bellinis. The popular outdoor patio boasts a vibrant scene each evening and features live music every Tuesday night. The extensive wine list offers varietals from regions around the globe, and brew enthusiasts will appreciate the comprehensive beer selection. Tapas and Vino is currently running a Not Just Tapas and Vino campaign. For listeners of the South Bay Show, mention the South Bay Show or South Bay by Jackie and receive 25% off a lunch or Saturday and Sunday brunch entree. Be sure to visit the Tapas and Vino Facebook page for weekly specials and discounts. Tapas and Vino is located at 1729 South Catalina Avenue in Redondo Beach. For more information, visit the website at tapasyvino.com. That's TapasYvino.com, tapasyvino, or call 310-791-8200. That's 310-791-8200. You can find out more about us at facebook.com/ The South Bay Show or visit our website at thesouthbayshow.com. Preparing for disaster in America. This is a subject that can never be treated lightly, but we do our best to make it interesting, engaging, and yes, even entertaining to learn the few key skills and primary information that could save your life, your family's lives, that of a neighbor in a time of crisis, or the life of a treasured pet. Our mission is to engage hearts and minds and build knowledge and skills to help you prepare for whatever may come. This show is a true collaboration with solid roots in the community and a partnership with the official disaster preparation establishment. Our producer is the president of the local Manhattan Beach Community Emergency Response Team Association, Mr. George Butts, and he is currently on vacation, and we wish him a pleasant, restful vacation. And, of course, with us today is owner, producer, writer of South Bay by Jackie.com, Jackie Balestra. Hey, Jackie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well this morning, Joe. How are you?
Very good, and I hope George is having a restful vacation and it's not like one of those working vacations.
We'll see.
Those are sometimes worse.
Yeah, sometimes those vacations aren't particularly restful.
No, exactly. Now, we have with us a guest that we've had before, and who is our guest today?
Our guest this morning is April Kelsey. April, who has been a guest on the show previously, as you mentioned, is the founder of Earthquake Solutions. She is an award-winning emergency management consultant who helps clients achieve intelligent and practical preparation for major disaster. April emphasizes preserving lives during a crisis event, identifies ways to improve safety during the immediate aftermath, and positions people, businesses, and communities for faster recovery. Her work has resulted in actual saves of lives, businesses, and homes in past disasters. April is on the leadership team for the Earthquake Country Alliance Southern California region, a consultant for the Great California Shakeout Project, a member of InfraGuard for Homeland Security Issues, and a credentialed responder nationwide for Children's Disaster Services. Welcome back to the show, April. We are so glad you could join us this morning.
Great. Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Joe, are you, we're not hearing you, Joe.
yes, I know.
Is that your computer doing weird things?
No, it was me being very quiet during your introduction. That was what I was doing.
Okay.
I just needed to undo what I was doing. So thank you so much, April, for joining us. We really appreciate it. When you join us, we get to ask all of our favorite questions about earthquakes. Earthquakes, of course, are the we could say it's the number one disaster on the mind of most Southern Californians. We sometimes worry about fires. We sometimes worry about mudslides. Rarely about other kinds of disasters like hurricanes or tornadoes. Earthquake is the big one for us in Southern California. So, April, my first question really is: do you have any updates on the impact of earthquakes on the general population, or any I would say advancements in earthquake detection or anything like that that are going on these days?
Well, there has been movement toward funding another stage forward in the ability to forecast earthquakes that was passed by the legislature, I believe. At least it was proposed. I don't remember if it was actually passed or not, but there's a lot of money involved in that, and a lot of time before we get even closer to the goal, which is eventually to be able to give a very finite and small amount of warning, probably a minute or less, but for high critical situations. When the San Andreas goes, if it starts from the south end of the Salton Sea, as is considered probably the most likely scenario, it will take over a minute to reach the central Los Angeles areas. And from start to finish, it's almost 4 minutes in length, passing through most areas in about 2 minutes. But that small amount of warning, once we get to that point, which is years out, will enable certain critical operations, perhaps an opportunity to shut down or chemical processes or other things that may be volatile.
For major industrial operations, refineries, and so forth, these critical 30 to 60, 70 seconds would be enough time for them to shut down major processes, to close valves and stuff like that. But for the average person, individual, most of whom aren't plugged into, I would say, the infrastructure 24/7, 365, they really won't get a warning. It's not for people, is it?
No. And the reality is, in a high magnitude quake, if it's anywhere close to you, you're not going to get any warning at all.
Yeah.
Proximity removes any time warning you have anyway. So it just depends on where you are and what the specifics of a particular earthquake are.
Right, exactly.
Since we're on the topic of earthquakes right here at the top of the show, April, here in the South Bay, we've been having a lot of them lately. There was one in Manhattan Beach. Was it yesterday, Joe?
Yesterday.
Yeah. We've been getting a whole bunch of them off at Marina Del Rey, El Segundo, Palos Verdes,
Inglewood. Inglewood. Very active.
But all you know, three pointers or so. So
right.
You know, nothing to particularly be concerned about. What's interesting to me is there's been a little uptick in the Pacific Northwest. But kind of keeping an eye on that. But the Brawley area, which is only about 12 miles from the south end of the fault, has continued to have light swarms. They had swarms in December of 2010. They had quite a lot of activity last fall, where they were having over several hundred a day. And just within the last couple of weeks, there's been a little bit of an uptick in the activity at that location as well. I believe, I couldn't say for sure without consulting some of the seismologists, but it's my understanding that that area was part of the system of at least six different faults that was affected by the Baja quake on April 4th of 2010.
What is a white swarm? Did you say white swarm?
light swarm.
What is that?
In other words, not a huge number of them. A swarm is when you're starting to have a multiplicity of earthquakes at the same location. But a heavy swarm of, you know, several hundred a day, a light swarm might be, you know, a few a day.
Mm-hmm. Oh, a light swarm, not a white swarm. Okay, sorry, I didn't hear that correctly.
Yeah.
All right.
Yes.
So we had a discussion with George before this show, and George Butts, the producer of this show, he had in his mind, he had decided that we were going to discuss, I guess, evacuation strategies and how they differ between fire and earthquakes. Is that the basic understanding that you have, that there's differences between fire and non-fire structure evacuations, and he wanted to sort of cover that topic?
Yes, this is something that I'm very strong on and have worked with my clients with for many years. Mm-hmm. We've all been raised on what I call the fire evacuation model, and most of the laws that, for instance, businesses and high occupancy facilities abide by are geared to the fire evacuation model. Now, in a fire, you have approximately 90 seconds. You might have as much as 2 minutes, but 90 seconds is pretty much the rule to get people out before they're overcome with smoke and fumes.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fire evacuation model has to be, you know, obviously orderly, but an emphasis on speed and efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
And so you move large amounts of people out very quickly. However, in other types of disasters, earthquakes being one, accidental explosions being another, bombs, certain kinds of things that do building damage, immediately the person occupying the building or people occupying the building are put into a debris field. They may have smoke and heavy particulate matter. They've almost certainly lost power, and visibility, even in daytime, may be impaired. They may have suffered sort of a mental psychological shock, and things suddenly look different than they did before. And when people start trying to move quickly in that kind of a situation, a lot of the injuries happen during the attempt to evacuate, because there's debris everywhere. There's stuff hanging from the ceiling. There's stuff to trip over and slip on. And, again, visibility is almost always impaired.
Right.
Psychological state and respiration are also affected. So, interestingly, a lot of employers don't understand that under the Cal OSHA regulations, they are actually required to establish as part of their plan different types of evacuation for various emergency circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
It can be found in Title 8 of the California Administrative Code. The employer shall establish in the emergency action plan the types of evacuation to be used in emergency circumstances. So that's actually a matter of law, but many businesses not only don't know about it, but certainly don't do that.
Right.
And so one of the things that I think is important when we talk about evacuation plans for earthquake is not only that the mode has to change from fast to slow for the occupants in order to avoid injury in the debris field, but the pre-planning for evacuation routes also should change.
Mm-hmm.
In my view, based on typical behavior patterns of how, let's say if you were to have the worst case scenario and you did have building damage or partial collapse, how is it most likely to affect how you're going to plan for those exit routes? We all know that something can go wrong even on a pre-planned route, and people have to adjust in the midst of the emergency, but there's also a lot of things that can be avoided by pre-planning.
Now, it's interesting that it's a matter of law that employers must provide different types of plans based on the emergency. Is that accurate?
That's right. That's right.
But, well, some buildings only have two exits maximum. I mean, the building that I am that I work in every day is 11 stories, and there's the stairs, two stairwells, and an elevator, and that's it. Three potential exits
from your floor.
Yes.
Okay.
Well,
and from the
I'm on the 11th floor, so I would say for the top, you know, 8 or 9 floors, there's only three exits, an elevator and two stairwells.
Okay. And do you know how many exits the whole building has at the ground level?
Oh, at the ground level? Well, two, front and back. Three. I apologize. Three, front, back, and side.
Okay. Well, every building, of course, is different. Mm-hmm. And some buildings are going to offer, have more exits in number.
Mm-hmm.
They may have, but regardless of the number of exits, whether few or many,
right,
there's usually a difference in the safety offered at each of those exits.
Mm-hmm.
In most buildings.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, you may find that at one of the exits, you may have a big power line drop.
Mm-hmm.
Where you could have wires let go and transformers throwing sparks.
Mm-hmm.
You could have, depending on the slope of the roof tiles, you could have more likelihood of someone being basically hit on the head by falling roof tiles at one location.
Mm-hmm.
And less so at another.
Right.
And so it's possible to look at the available exits and to decide, basically to rate them, 1, 2, 3, 4. If I have my choice, this is the best one.
Right.
This is my alternate 2 and alternate 3, and so on.
Right. You, April, had sent us some photographs to illustrate what the issues might be in evacuations, and I get. The basic gist of it is that you would choose an exit for volume, for just quick volume exit for fire so that everyone can get out quickly, and you would choose a different exit for earthquake that might not involve falling debris or might be more sheltered from falling debris, but less high volume exit for earthquake. Or obviously, if your choice was good and better, but in the case of most situations, it's choices and trade-offs to make. But I guess if it were a fire, you'd want to choose a high volume exit that people could get out quickly, and if it were an earthquake, you'd want to choose the highest volume exit that did not expose people to falling debris if you could make such a choice. Is that right?
I'm actually not sure that that's exactly correct, because each situation is very situational.
Mm.
Just like the saying, all disasters are local.
Mm.
If for instance, you have a, I'm thinking of an assessment I did recently on a large church facility with approximately 2,000 attenders. And in some cases, here was one of the things that comes out from situations like this, is that sometimes it's better to keep people in the building longer than it is to put them immediately outside.
Hmm.
And I know that goes against the psychological instinct and that desire to get out into open space, but a lot may depend on how, where you can get to once you leave the building.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if you are in a situation where that you've got several entrances, three or four entrances, but three out of four are difficult and possibly lethal. In this particular case with the church, they had a sky bridge between two buildings, and I knew because the shape of the buildings were opposed to each other that there would be pounding on the sky bridge and the very likelihood that it would fall. Well, there were three exits right underneath the sky bridge.
Hmm.
And so I didn't want to put people out that particular direction.
Not good building planning.
So I kind of overloaded the better exits in that case because of the rather, high likelihood of lethalities at those particular vulnerable exits.
Right.
Now, if I had other exits, more exits available than I did, I would probably want to spread my occupancy load a bit, putting them through the nearest, highest rated, closer exit. So it really involves some analysis of the actual facility to think through what the issues are.
And of course you make your best choices in a,
yes.
in a world of less than great choices. You make your best choices.
Exactly.
That is fascinating that's part of what you do, isn't it, for Earthquake Solutions and your consultancy business, is that you read each situation, each facility, each organization's profile, and come up with solutions for them in their particular circumstances.
Yes, that's very much part of what I do, because everything is very situational. The facilities are different, the populations are different, the usages, the operations are different.
Mm-hmm.
And my whole goal when I work with clients, whether I'm working with a business or a faith-based institution, government agency, or even individuals and families, is to look primarily first at the life safety issues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
That sounds like planning that everybody should do in their own home.
Absolutely.
Know your exits, but more importantly, know what you could walk into walking out that exit. What you
absolutely.
Could
do.
Yeah.
So one of the things that's very self-evident for most people, but you don't think of it until you really start to get into the mindset of which exits could be compromised in an earthquake versus which exits could be compromised in a different type of disaster, like a fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at a picture of a gentleman standing next to a chimney and another chimney that's been completely degraded, obviously, in an earthquake. So it's anything, any high promontory point that could fall off, or fascia from a building that could fall off. Or
yes.
Here, there's a school breezeway that's completely
yes.
fallen down. I suppose it was architectural and pretty, but it came down in the midst of this building disaster earthquake.
Yes, I have some comments on those pictures that I had sent ahead to you.
Sure. Well, then let's start. Let's start with the one right near the top, the window sharding.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Almost every building is going to have a glass hazard of some sort, and so if you have a building, for instance, that is two stories and has glass in the front of it to make a nice grand entrance. Mm-hmm. Even though that glass likely has to be safety glass, it's still going to present a hazard when you lose that diaphragm and that shatters, which is very common in earthquakes. And so if you have, for instance, a building that has a prominent amount of glass on one side of the building, much more extensively than on the other three sides, that particular side of your building may be more vulnerable to some sort of collapse. So that would argue if that nice glass front, for instance, was in fact the front, that maybe some of your side or rear exits would be a better choice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we're talking about the chimneys in a residential situation, not only do they tend to fall, but there are two things that we tend to see. One is a situation where the chimney comes up the side of the building, and a lot of times they won't just shear off at the top or at the roof line, but they will fall outward, typically outward from the building. And oftentimes you'll see in residential communities where there's a driveway right next to that, and people will park their cars there, and you'll see from the earthquake forensics a number of cars that have been basically covered in the masonry that's come down.
Mm-hmm.
In this, when a chimney cracks or comes down toward the structure itself, one of the things that can happen is it can actually break through the roof line and through the interior ceiling into the living space. In the June 28, 1992 Landers Big Bear sequence that happened, there was actually a little three-year-old boy by the name of Joy Bishop that was killed by that sort of thing. And the family was here visiting from out of state, and the house was full of house guests, and the little boy was sleeping in a sleeping bag in front of the fireplace when the earthquake happened. And so one of the things that tells us is there are also ways to strengthen buildings and to make them more safe. For instance, by adding sheer plywood in the attic area and in between the chimney and the interior ceiling, you can create a situation where those bricks are more likely to shed off the slope of the roof line rather than break through into the living space.
What a tragedy.
Now, yes, and as to the breezeway, one of the things you see in a lot of schools in California are these breezeways, and typically what I see when schools practice evacuation drills is they walk right along under the breezeway instead of stepping away from the building into the open space. Now, in the Baja quake, El Mayor quake, on April 4th of 2010, there were some breezeways that came down in Imperial County, and one of the fire people that was doing a debriefing on that event said that some of the debris weighed as much as 10,000 pounds, and had children been in school, there would have been quite a different scenario. We were fortunate it occurred on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. And so one of my big recommendations would be for schools and people who have buildings with breezeways is to step away from the building, and even if you get only 10 or 15 feet away from the building for your travel path, it may be important for your safety.
Wow.
We've all seen the pictures of that, you know, or in person, school drills where all the kids line up and walk out. And yeah, I can see it. I can see them walking under that breezeway.
Wow. Do you want to continue? Let's take a break. And we'll do a station break. You're listening to the South Bay Show, Preparing for Disaster in America. And we're talking with April Kelsey, founder of Earthquake Solutions. We're talking about evacuation modalities, the different ways one might evacuate based on the type of disaster that you're facing, and how it can make a difference going out one direction versus another, especially in some of these commercial or government buildings like schools and so forth. And we haven't even talked about like hospitals or other large structures like that. But at this time, we'd like to take a break and thank a sponsor. Jackie, what sponsor would we like to thank today?
Well, you know, Joe, it's never too early to begin planning for your financial future. When it comes to protecting your assets and hard-earned dollars, you'll want experienced professionals with a proven track record and flawless reputation on your team. Briganti, Cameron, Waters & Strong, certified public accountants and consultants, is the largest full-service accounting firm in the South Bay, and they are dedicated to providing professional services of the highest quality. The partners are South Bay residents deeply committed to serving the communities where they live, work, and play. They support a variety of local nonprofit organizations such as Skate Park PB, Palos Verdes Peninsula Land Conservancy, the Torrance South Bay YMCA, Palos Verdes Rotary, and Pediatric Therapy Network, among others. BCWS prides itself on providing national accounting technical experience with the personal attention of a local company. This commitment to uphold high standards of excellence has proven key to their success and first-rate reputation. Their ultimate goal and reward is to see their clients achieve financial success as they define it, whether that means helping them to reduce their tax burden, assisting them with planning to ensure their financial security, succession planning, exit strategies, and wealth transfer. The partners and professionals of BCWS are committed to providing their clients with the expertise and guidance they need to reach their financial goals. Briganti, Cameron, Waters & Strong is dedicated to helping you navigate to financial success. You can call 310-542-0011 for a free consultation or visit the website at www.bcws.com. And we had Chris Strong from BCWS on the show last week.
Yes.
That was a good show.
Great interview.
Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah. Actually, accounting is quite interesting to me. I found it fascinating.
Yes, and all the trouble you can get in if it's not done correctly.
Exactly.
As those nitwits over at Enron learned.
So, April, we were taking a tour of various issues that can occur. You had sent us some photographs. Where would you like to pick up?
Let's talk a little bit about the exterior ramp and open stairway construction like you see in some apartment houses or maybe motels and things.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that those being tied to the outer part of the building, of course, they can shed off just like anything else and frequently do. And so one of the things that can happen in an apartment house or motel situation also is that, let's say you have a major quake and people are rattled, and especially in the motel, if they're traveling or something, they're going to be particularly disoriented. And you can have a situation where a ramp like that can already have fallen away when they throw open the door and try to step out. We saw some instances of injuries in the Northridge earthquake, for instance, from that sort of thing, with broken legs and things when people basically went down a floor because they didn't even look before they stepped out. But the other thing you can have is you can have the ramp or the staircase actually be weakened during the first set of shocks. And then suddenly a ramp that's used to taking light traffic, a few people at a time at most, is suddenly overloaded with the maximum weight capacity, if you will, with everybody trying to step out at once, and it can fall when people are actually en route.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a situation where being very aware, especially if you live in a building like that, that you shouldn't just automatically try to leave without looking out, making sure the ramp is still there, possibly even test the ramp by maybe throwing a chair out or something to see if it's really shaky, and probably to avoid stepping on the ramp at the same time that everybody else is trying to leave the building.
Wow. That's tough, especially, you know, in the heat of the moment. I can tell that would be the right way to do things, but you know,
hard to have that kind of presence of mind.
Yes, exactly. Wait, we have to get out. Oh, you first.
Oh, Joe, you're bad.
Oh, that's funny. I crack myself up sometimes. I think, you know, it's we've been talking. talking about it. We've mentioned the P word several times. The planning aspect is perhaps one floor at a time, one section of the building at a time. Those kinds of evacuation plan requirements can lead to fewer people hitting the stairwell all at the same time.
Exactly.
Hopefully.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that's part of what someone would do when they would be consulting with this organization is you may be vulnerable to everyone getting out at the same time. Let's plan to stage them. That's a good idea. And what's the next photograph?
I put in a couple of photos that I had sent to you where you showing buildings that had in the front areas they had slender supports. Two-story buildings with slender supports at both levels, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
One was an intact building, and one was showing how the supports had let go and that the building was red-tagged.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to watch for those things and what's also called a soft-story situation, mm-hmm. where you have, for instance, a garage under living areas or occupancy areas. And there, a lot of times you'll see bank buildings in like mid-rise commercial areas where the corner of the building, there's one post at the very corner so that there's a diagonal entrance and people can walk under it around the sidewalks and so on, and
mm-hmm.
two stories of glass, and it all looks very nice and business-like and commercial, but it also means it's a vulnerable area of the building.
Right. Beautiful, but deadly.
Yeah, potentially deadly, yes.
Wow.
You know, I'm going to veer off here a little bit just because we are talking about safe evacuations from buildings. Several weeks ago, Joe, we had a guest on the show that was sort of in this field. She designed and sold devices to assist people in getting them downstairs and stuff if they were immobile.
Right. I remember.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was in a building recently. You know, I can't remember which one it was. It might have been the power plant. When they had that art exhibit,
mm-hmm.
but we had to walk up a stairwell, and I saw one of these devices. The very first time I saw one, it was on the wall,
mm-hmm.
and it was one. I don't know what it was because it was wrapped, but it said something on it that if you needed to get somebody down the stairs and they couldn't walk, and so
right.
this was something you could use to get somebody down the stairs a lot more easily.
Yeah,
I saw one for the very first time.
Yeah,
I just thought I'd mention that.
Okay, do you? April, do you not only consult with these organizations on the types of evacuation plans, but do you actually suggest tools and techniques? I mean,
absolutely, and depending on you know the range of things the client needs and wants, I do teach citizen search and rescue and some particularly customized ways of operating under the incident command system that are going to help an ordinary person handle something that's going to be overwhelming to them. So
mm-hmm.
I have a full range of services that I offer, and the assessment is where you start because that's where you find out where the vulnerabilities are that are specific. See, a lot of people, when they do a business vulnerability assessment, they typically go down and list all of the things that can happen, structure fire, earthquake, maybe some sort of terrorism attacks or pandemic flu, or they'll start, you know, infrastructure failure, power outage, blah, blah, blah. They'll list all those kinds of things, but what they won't do in the vulnerability analysis is look at how it's going to specifically affect them. That's where this idea of looking at your facilities, can you strengthen them? Can you, by pre-planning, prevent some of the injuries and deaths that are going to occur?
Mm-hmm.
Can that inform your continuity plan? For instance, if you learn in that process that, and I'm not saying collapse is likely, but in a worst-case scenario, just the type of building you have is going to be especially vulnerable. Like if you lived or worked in a unreinforced masonry building that was not retrofitted.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if, you know, believe it or not, there are some people that don't know how dangerous that is, and they learn that how dangerous it is, they may decide to move. They may also know for continuity purposes that they're going to have to set up operations in an alternate location after the quake because they're not going to feel like going back inside until it's fully inspected
right.
and assured to be safe.
Right.
So there's a lot of information that can be gained just by taking a good hard look at your facility and how it's likely to behave.
We continue to come back to, it seems, this is just a matter of expert advice coupled with the common sense of, well, yes, different disaster, different profile of preparation and planning. And
we're all about the planning, Joe. We're all about preparation. That's what the show is all about.
That's right.
And, you know, we've seen it every single time there's an earthquake, we see it where the bricks are laying on the sidewalk, people come running out of their buildings and are getting hit on the head with falling debris. We see it all the time.
Right.
But that, I guess that's human nature. When you're inside a structure and it starts shaking, you want to get out as fast as you can, and you know, you're not taking into account the dangers you could encounter outside.
Are there some types of hazards that we haven't talked about that you encounter when you do these consultations, April? Are we missing any large areas
I would say that what a lot of people are not familiar with is, believe it or not, but the single most common type of structural collapse is when an outer wall sheds away.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, it's not just that you're going to get beamed by roof tiles and fallen chimneys and breaking glass and all of that. The truth of the matter is that if you're trying to escape the building in the actual shaking, or if you're a little bit too soon and not aware when you're trying to transition out of the building, especially if aftershocks are going to be coming very hard and fast usually afterwards,
mm-hmm.
you could still get that collapse during that transition period of time of transition. And so I think it's really, really important to think about in your building, if collapse were to start, where would it start from and how would it propagate?
Okay. So you would help your clients with that, and then they could decide then, once they had in their minds, oh, this is likely how our building might fail, depending on
right.
the severity of the earthquake, then these are the kinds of exits and or strategies we can utilize.
And there may be things that you can do to strengthen the building.
I
can't remember if we talked last time about the Jennifer Lynn Merrick Memorial Law.
No, please. Refresh.
Okay. In the San Simeon quake a few years back, in the Paso Robles area, there was a building called the Acorn Building that was owned by a trust with suites inside subleased to small businesses. And a small business owner during the quake actually told his two employees to leave the building during the shaking, which is the first most dangerous thing you can do during the shaking. And the two young ladies were killed when there was a partial collapse of the building. And that led to the adoption later of the Jennifer Lynn Merrick Memorial Law. But there's more to the story than that, because the building in question building owners had already been notified by the local jurisdiction that they were required to retrofit the building seismically.
Mm-hmm.
They were still within the grace period to do that, but had not done that. In fact, had not even started. The building next to it, which had been fully retrofitted, continue to stand. That building was a total loss. The two young ladies died. And so the California Seismic Safety Commission said out of that whole case that this puts a burden on employers to make sure that people know what to do and to end confusion about what is and what is not safe to do, which is another development in the law. But the suits, because of the death of the ladies, went all the way to the California Supreme Court, and out of that came the Jennifer and Merrick Memorial Law, which requires certain vulnerable buildings to actually post earthquake warnings on their exterior. And that warning is not just about being in the building. It also explicitly says you may not be safe inside or near the building.
Okay. If you see that warning on a building.
Sorry. We shouldn't be laughing, but it's kind of funny.
It's a
big sign of big red letters.
Right.
Post, on the front of the building saying this building has not been retrofitted, it's not safe, enter and leave at your own danger.
Right.
There's specific wording, but that's the effect of the wording.
I mean, I would...
I haven't seen one of these yet, have you?
I have not.
I have, and on actual buildings. And the thing is that a lot of businesses don't know that if you have one of these buildings, you are also required to disclose that in your lease agreements and, of course, at point of sale. Mm-hmm. So earthquake history informs us as to some of our options. It informs us of some of our legal requirements. And, again, we learn something from every disaster.
One of those signs would be worse than getting a C rating from the Department of Health for a restaurant.
Right.
you walk by those restaurants, they don't have the A in the window, they have a B or a C or, worse.
Keep walking.
Yeah, exactly. I imagine that sign would have the same effect.
And yes. I can see the reason that the law was enacted, and certainly the proponents of the law were angry that their loved ones had died, not knowing that the building they were in was severely compromised, and it was well known that it was severely compromised and needed to be retrofitted, but the owner simply had not gotten around to doing the retrofit.
That's true. And the building owners did lose the financial part of the lawsuit, even though they were within the grace period.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's very interesting. And I'm sure the facts of the case are particular. But as we have been talking, this is people from other parts of the country may find the discussion to be one-sided. I mean, aren't you guys going to talk about fire, or aren't you guys going to talk about God knows what? But it's not. There's no reason to talk about hurricane or reason to talk about tornadoes. They don't happen here. We're talking about earthquakes because that's what Southern Californians live with as a daily potential disaster. And it doesn't matter about the weather. Typically, even though people say there's a kind of earthquake weather, but it can be sunny out and we can have a disaster of epic proportions.
Anytime it's not your typical sunny Southern California weather,
right.
People say it's earthquake weather.
Right.
You get a little humidity, oh, it's earthquake weather. Oh, we get a little rain, it's earthquake weather. It's windy, it's earthquake weather.
Right, that's funny.
Hail?
All the mess. But I would also say that there are certain typical building behavior patterns that you can expect in other types of situations, such as a high wind situation.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Southern California, we had high winds in the San Gabriel Valley just over about 18 months ago. that did a tremendous amount of financial damage and had people without power for over a week. And so there are things that we can expect from those things, and no matter what part of the country you live in, and certainly broad areas of the east of us are subject to the New Madrid fault going off again. Mm-hmm. And many of the buildings in the east are not even built to the same seismic standards as we require here in Southern California. And so all of those types of vulnerabilities would be an even bigger issue for those people who would be within the range of anything that might happen on the New Madrid. The historical information on that, there were three very large quakes in the 1800s that I think began in the Missouri area and caused effects as far away as Boston.
Mm. So are we, I mean, there was recently that earthquake in Washington, D.C., I believe. Wasn't it Washington, D.C. that did rattle a lot of nerves on the East Coast?
Yes.
Are we saying that if, you know, obviously there's a great deal of concern here, and we are preparing for, quote unquote, the big one. But is it in your estimation likely that a greater loss of life and a greater disaster in terms of human casualties could occur on the East Coast rather than here on the West Coast, where we've all been, you know, preparing for decades?
That's a hard question to answer. I personally believe, and it's just a personal opinion, it's certainly, you know, not even the best scientists know what's going to happen, but based on several decades of observing seismicity in Southern California and a couple of decades of looking at seismicity on a global basis, I do believe that we are, and my personal opinion is, we are dangerously close to the big one we've heard about for years, and it will be a very significant, very different kind of experience than anyone in Southern California has ever experienced before, unless they happen to have been in a high magnitude quake in another country. Mm. I think we're probably, seismically speaking, closer to that event than something happening on the New Madrid, but at the same time, their whole seismic history and behavior and the kinds of ground soils and things are very different. Mm-hmm. And I'm less familiar with that area. I will say that I have a sort of theory that I've never asked the seismologists about, but I really think the Washington, D.C. quake is actually related to other seismic behavior that's happened. It actually was centered in Christiansburg, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And that was an area that responded seismically to the Christmas Day 2004 Indonesian quake and tsunami that was over 9 points. And that very large quake was so strong, it actually caused the entire Earth to wobble on its axis.
Hmm.
And so this activity in that area had already seen some noticeable, traceable effects of the 2004 earthquake. And then we had the January 2010 Haitian earthquake that was so devastating.
Mm-hmm.
And my sense in the last few years is if you looked at, you had a couple of quakes in New Zealand and Indonesia and then Japan. And then on this side, you went from Chile to Baja, and Chile also being a great quake in February 2010, followed by the Baja quake in April of 2010. I just wonder if there isn't something happening just based on pattern recognition alone that suggests that seismic forces globally are basically pushing in a northward direction. Again, that's a personal theory, completely unsupported or researched by science.
So. I understand. But these kinds of impressions by professionals in the field, though, do add up to a general consensus that, and we see it in our role as reporters, and you could say on the entertainment side of disaster in America. We see what we believe to be unprecedented economic activity around survival, around doomsday preppers, around all areas of disaster preparation. There is certainly a groundswell of interest in getting prepared, in being prepared, and that's it's not just here in the U.S. It's a global phenomena.
Well, I certainly hope more people are prepared.
Mm-hmm.
If you think, for instance, about how we will be isolated in Southern California when the big one hits,
mm-hmm.
With 25 million people, it's going to make a big difference whether only 10% of them are prepared or whether 50, 60, or 70% of them are prepared.
Right.
Because we all only have the resources we have in the basin at the time that it occurs.
Right, exactly. What has continues to lengthen every time we talk about this with an expert in disaster preparation, the time lengthens. I mean, it was, you know, the typical 48 to 72 hours, and then most experts we've talked to have said, you know, it's going to be a week before any appreciable services and or relief in terms of products on the shelves and that kind of stuff is restored, and it could be longer if major highways are damaged or impassable.
Yeah, well, most of the people we're talking to, at least 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And we've had several people say as much as long as a month.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And if you look at it now, of course, by the time you get 6 months out, there will be some kinds of things that are flowing in and out.
Right.
But, you know, Lucy Jones herself, the head of the multi-hazard project here at the USGS Pasadena office, has said that a number of people will be without touch water for at least 6 months.
Wow.
That doesn't sound so good for a desert environment like Los Angeles.
Yeah.
No.
A potable water crisis could be devastating.
Yes. And the big one scenario, the San Andreas scenario that's most likely, is going to actually basically offset the I-15 corridor and most land routes in and out. Well, that takes out our water supply, our infrastructure, and everything else. And as part of the multi-hazard study that led to the shakeout project,
mm-hmm.
they also discovered there's piped aviation fuel through there and other hazards as well. And so even repairing those corridors is going to take a great deal of time.
Wonderful. Piped aviation fuel.
One more thing to worry about. I didn't have that one on my list.
We've been talking with April Kelsey, the founder of Earthquake Solutions, and you can find out more about April and what her company does and her consulting activities and services at earthquakesolutions.com. EarthquakeSolutions.com. We've talked, I think, previously about what a wonderful and amazing domain name that is, EarthquakeSolutions.com. I'm glad that you actually are involved in Earthquake Solutions and don't sell God knows what lamps or something for earthquake preparedness.
Yeah.
This lamp will survive an earthquake. I don't want to know about that. I want to survive an earthquake.
Thank you for having me, Joe and Jackie, and give my best to George.
We will certainly. Thank you very much for joining us. Of course, George will be back next Tuesday. Thank you, Jackie.
Always a pleasure, Joe.
All righty. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.